Sonnets at Dawn, the podcast about 18th, 19th, and 20th century women writers. I am your host, Lauren Burke, and today I am joined by a special guest. I think you guys know her. Our co-host is Dr. Amber Poliat. So many of you guys know Amber from our past episodes on Anne Bronte, Victorian governesses, which was just, that was a lovely bad life that we did with you. Also, of course, literary tourism. But today she is here to talk to us about the Blue Castle. So, Amber, in case everyone has missed your past episodes, will you just please give us a little background info about yourself?
Sure. So I work on 19th century literature with a special focus on the literary afterlives of the Bronte family. I'm really interested in multimodal forms of engagement with their lives and legacies. And these include things like adaptations and biographical fiction, literary tourism, and artistic responses to their work and biographies.
Which is one of my favorite things, too. I'm really into this also.
It is the best.
And we have a whole like mini series coming up about like some of this stuff. So we actually might have to reach back out to you for our next mini series. But right now we're talking about the Blue Castle and Ellen Montgomery. So I just want to quickly ask, was this your first time reading the Blue Castle? And just, you know, how are you feeling about it?
So this is actually my first time reading Ellen Montgomery, period. So I really, really enjoyed this novel. And firstly, I loved it for its humor. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of my favorites like Cold Comfort Farm, The Brontes Went to Woolworths, and The Diary of a Provincial Lady, all of those interwar 1920s and 30s novels about these, you know, bright young thing heroines. I really, really enjoyed Balancy. And I thought Montgomery really had this flair for describing the absurdities of custom and convention and their power to circumscribe and limit the possibilities of our lives and especially women's lives, just because we take them for granted. And I really love the sense of possibility that's explored in this novel. The idea that we can make one small decision and it really has the power to radically change the course of our lives. Balance these smaller acts of rebellion, like refusing to take the purple pills or to laugh at Uncle Benjamin's stupid, demeaning jokes, lead to this momentous decision to leave her stultifying life as an unmarried daughter dependent at home and then earn her living as Sissy's nurse. So I think there's a really empowering message here for readers today as well, that our lives aren't over and that there are always these new decisions to be made that could potentially lead to new pleasures and opportunities. So for me, it was a really great book to read during the pandemic, which kept us all at home and in a kind of stasis.
Totally. I didn't mean for this to be like a pandemic read, in quotes.
But it was perfect.
But it was.
Yeah.
Sometimes books just find us at the right time, which is great. So before we jump into the interview for today, I am going to very quickly recap chapters 16 through 30. And I say quick, but then like this week, there was so much that happened. So feel free to jump in with any thoughts while I do this recap. But here we go. Okay. Valency arrives at Roaring Abel's house to begin her work as a housekeeper, and he compliments her ankles. And it's the first compliment she has ever received in her life. I was like, oh my God.
Ankles are sexy.
They are. And, you know, she's super pleased. Like, he's super pleased. She settles right in as the companion to his daughter, Sissy, who is, like, also just really happy to have her there. Valency and Sissy have known each other since they were children, but they haven't been friendly, especially recently. Sissy at this point is practically sort of like a myth in town and definitely something of a cautionary tale. She had a baby out of wedlock and then fell ill after that baby passed. The Sterlings, among others, just, you know, gossip about her and speculate that Barney might have been the father. These women form a very strong bond, and Valency even tells her about her blue castle. I do love this point when they're like, ooh, I have a blue castle. Oh, I have a blue castle. Great. Love it. Barney is also a frequent visitor to the house and often offers to like stop into town and pick up supplies for everyone, which I thought was super sweet.
Helpful and cute.
I know. I was like, Barney, that's when he won me over, I think, actually.
Yeah. He would go to Whole Foods and let you know before he went and like bring you back some things.
He'd be like, I know what you want on the hot bar. Like, I got you. And I appreciate that, Barney. I really do. Valency is a little worried that there may have been something between Sissy and Barney, but she soon realizes that that was all just nonsense, that they are just friends. Mm-hmm. The Sterlings make multiple attempts to get Valency to come back home, which is interesting because it's not like they cared that much before.
No, they just to mistreat her more, I guess.
Yeah. I guess they need a punching bag. Yeah. Mrs. Fredericks even says that it would be much easier if Valency had just died so she can mourn her properly, which is a really strong thing to say about your daughter. chapters 20 and 21 are some of my favorite chapters in the book. And this is when Valency gets her first paycheck and she buys that green dress and she goes dancing. Unfortunately, things get a little rough at the dance, but thankfully, Barney turns up at exactly the right time. Imagine that.
And he punches people for her, which is romantic, too.
Hero rescues her. They hop into his car, and on the way home, they run out of gas, and they are stranded. I mean, like, hello, romance trope. Mm. While they're in the car, Valency says that John Foster says that if two people can sit in silence for 30 minutes without talking, then they can be friends. And only if they can be friends, they can be something more. Which is interesting.
Yes.
A lot of John Foster quotes gonna pop up here.
Yeah.
That guy. And I feel like it's then that Valency realizes that she's in love with Barney. He has to give her his jacket.
His overcoat, which is so sweet. And he buttons her up.
Mm-hmm. The atmosphere, like, for me in this moment is, like, all charged and sexy mm-hmm. and romantic. And they are interrupted by a passing car, which turns out to be Valency's uncle and her cousin Olive. Heated words are exchanged, and Olive just can't wait to go back and trash talk Valency to the rest of the family, I'm sure. I'm sure she was, like, keeping all these mental notes, and she's like, yeah, can't wait to tell my aunt. The next chapter, Mrs. Frederick stops attending church because all anyone can talk about is how Valency and Barney are essentially dating, in my mind. I mean, pre-dating, maybe. Yeah. I think, Amber, we're about the same age. So,
yeah.
Do you remember, like, back in high school, how people used to say talking? Like, we're just talking. Like, we're not.
Yes. Yeah. Like, you're laying the foundations and all this John Foster chat. Can mm-hmm. I get you some groceries? Do you need some cod? Like,
yes.
All laying, you know, the essential groundwork for a fulfilling relationship, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not dating quite yet. They're talking, guys. They're talking in italics. So in chapter 23, Sissy makes this deathbed confessional about the boy she fell in love with, who was the father of her baby, and she passes. And I cried because that was a really rough chapter to get through, actually.
And she's so brave and self-sacrificial when she realizes mm-hmm. that he only proposes to her out of a sense of duty and custom. And you know, that's quite free-spirited, I think, in the same way that Barney and Valency, like, this is why they all get along. They're the same, mm-hmm. the same kind of spirit, this refusal to just accept conventions.
Yes.
And to live inauthentically.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I got I really upset Sissy. For Sissy, because I was just like, man, she should have had more time.
I know. And like, when I first was introduced to Sissy, I just thought she's like this sad, penitent, fallen woman who's mm-hmm. maligned by society, but she's so sweet and gentle and she's totally undeserving of this, which of course she is. But actually, you know, she's really strong willed. I mean, to decide to raise your child on your own without any, you know, without the benefits of marriage, without the protections of marriage, without the monetary support, and to go back to her father's house. That's incredibly brave.
Yeah, it really was. Oh, man. You know,
I love Sissy.
Hero. Sissy got done dirty. Next up, we have Sissy's funeral, which Valency helps organize. And it's so infuriating because her whole family turns up. I was so mad at them.
Yes.
And of course, they expect her to just come home right now. But she has other plans. She proposes to Barney in a scene that I could actually discuss forever, and we can talk about it after the interview. They get married. Valency goes to Barney's home for the first time, and guess what? It is a total blue castle. And then she just starts living her best life. Like, she cuts her hair, she's reading books by the fire, she's going on these long walks with Barney. They're going swimming and stuff. Like, she's like, oh, teach me how to do all this stuff. I mean, I know she starts ice skating at one point. Like, she's just having a great time. She's having fewer and fewer attacks. Imagine that. The only downside is that her family has disowned her, but I guess that's not really a downside, honestly. It's fine. She seems fine with it. And there's this other thing. Barney has a mysterious shed, or chamber, if you will, where he goes to work every single day. And he instructs Valency never to go in there and never to open the mail. And she complies. She's like, all right. But of course, us, the reader, we're like, what the hell? What's going on in the shed? We need to know. And so that's what we're going to discuss quite a bit this episode. We're going to talk about the shed. We're going to talk about the Bluebeard myth and sex. But first, we have an interview with Dr. Brenton Dickison, who is a university lecturer and freelance writer who lives on Prince Edward Island. He is also the host of The Modcast, which is a podcast all about Ellen Montgomery and features Montgomery scholars like Kate Scarth, who you will remember from last week, and Trenna Frever, who is coming up. You can check out The Modcast wherever you get your podcast and follow the show on Twitter at LMMIModcast. That's LMMI Modcast. So, kind of a weird question to ask someone who was born on Prince Edward Island, but when did you discover Ellen Montgomery?
Yeah. So I'm Canadian. I grew up in Prince Edward Island. Not just that, but so my 4-H club was in the church that was replaced just as Maud Montgomery was getting married and then moving to Ontario. So the new church, the new Presbyterian church, which became United Church of Canada. So that's like, I did pageants there as a kid, like community stuff. And then 4-H was in the basement, which was like, I had like a cattle club. Anyway, I think your listeners know, some will know what 4-H is. And so it was there. So I would play as a kid in her graveyard, right? Like, that was just a field early on. And a field trip would be like to, you know, we would go to the Green Gables house and walk down Lover's Lane or something, which was hilarious when you're grade six, right? Like all the possibilities of jokes that you can have in that sort of situation. And then right across the street from that was a place called Rainbow Valley, which is Montgomery's, I think, sixth Anne book that she wrote, fifth Anne novel that she wrote. And it was just like a kind of a terrible but fun amusement-y park, but really like a park with some stuff in it, like a place to go have lunch, but also rides and water slides and stuff. So that was our world, right? Like 5% of our economy is tourism.
That's crazy.
And yeah, I know. It was building before Montgomery came along. One of the reasons that Montgomery caught, I think, was because other big people were kind of pushing Prince Edward Island as a destination place. And then she did her thing and it just kind of came alive over the next century or so. So it was there, and I grew up, when I was a kid, the Kevin Sullivan films, Anne of Green Gables films, and then the sequel came out, which we watched and watched again and again because there wasn't much to watch in rural Canada at the time. And it still had like the Sears commercials. Like, so these were VHS tapes. Right. Yeah. And so it was like the Maytag Man or something or whatever it was, or terrible. Like, so the dress fashions were no longer fashionable by the time we're watching these tapes over and over again. Right. So that was, that was my Montgomery, but I probably read Anne of Green Gables as a kid, but it didn't strike me. I was very much a boy reader and I really read things that boys would read. So very active stuff. And so it overlapped with what girls would read at times, but I just wasn't, I had nothing against them. No one put the book in my hand read. And in fact, I didn't know a Montgomery reader. My grandmother was mad at Ellen Montgomery because she pronounced, she called it not Prince Edward Island all the time, but P.E. Island. And my grandmother hated that. And I don't know why, like, it doesn't make any sense to me, but it was just so minimalistic, I think, and so little. And so we just didn't have it. Yeah. And I read like Anne de Pignon Vert, like the French as a kid, but not the English. So it may have been part of my French curriculum or something, or maybe I did a book study or something like that. And then it was, nothing. And then, but you know, like, we watch the movies when they come out and we're always kind of interested, and some are good and some are terrible. The one what was the president of the United States name? West Wing guy, you know, that was a terrible one. And this Anne with the E is kind of interesting. And so we've always kept track with that. But in Japan, then Japanese people, we lived in Japan, rural Japan for a couple of years, 3 years, and they were really interested, of course. And so then, well, we need to kind of go back. And so, you know, we had talks about it and stuff like that. And so, but then when it came to just reading the novels, it was my wife who is a big reader, but we have almost like no overlap except children's books. And so then it was in a way of kind of, I was just like, well, maybe I'll just like, I'd like to read something she's reading so that I can connect with her and we can talk about the book. And so then I read, you know, just Anne of Green Gables. Like, that's not a terrible, surprising thing. I was like, oh, well, this is like, it had a kind of literary quality to it that I had noticed before. The character is vivacious. Like, she just jumps off the page. It's funny. Like, it's really kind of funny. Yeah, it was just really good. And then I read Emily of New Moon and I'm like, oh, well, wait, okay, this is a thing, right? So this is a real, and it's a writerly book. Emily of New Moon, the Emily character is a writer and it's a writerly book. And I'm like, well, there's really something here. And so then it was just, I was just kind of grabbing stuff as it comes. Sometimes I would listen to an audio book or grab a book or read a short story. I started teaching the short story, Each in His Own Tongue, which is a gorgeous short story. I started teaching that in a curriculum. And then eventually I'm like, okay, I think I actually have something to say. So I went to the first conference, presented a paper, started working it up academically. And then, so now I read a bit more cleverly. I'm reading kind of chronologically, I'm going through. So, but she has so many short stories and poems.
Oh, wow. How are you doing with that? Because there's kind of a lot.
Well, yeah, I thought I was doing okay. And then I found like I was missing like 100 early short stories. So I have to go and backfill a little. And then the poems, like finding the dates. And so I've gotten, there's a bibliography now. And so I just need like 2 hours. I'll put on some like really loud music and I'll organize it. And then I can get going again. Because she has, there's a bunch of letters and then she has all these journals. And so you really can kind of read through her life if you can organize it well. And it's kind of intriguing, a little disturbing to do that as you go through. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot. I can't think of another author that we've covered on this show that has as much in their archive, like maybe Willa Cather, yeah, there's so much with Montgomery.
So we have, but you know, it's funny, Lauren, you say that it's actually sad how little we have of Montgomery because she was regarded as some sort of public national treasure, but not actually as a writer. And that's the difference, is that she died in the World War II. By that time, there should have been an archivist or a scholar or somebody that got her papers You know, her library disappeared, like the books she read, who knows what annotations were there. We don't have everything about her book reading. She was a voracious book reader. In the 21st century, that, like, for someone of that level, she was a Royal Society member, you know, she, like, international superstar. She's in, by my calculation, she's in the 100 million book sales club today. Like, she just, like, it, like, there was, she was already, they already had national parks named after her before she died. And then nobody thought, you know, maybe we should get her papers, you know, maybe it's, well, they, she's a woman, she's a children's writer. Like, nobody thought there was any minister's wife. There was nobody, nobody thought there was any kind of depth there. So, and that's like, so we have a bunch, but we have what either she or our closest friends kept for her. We don't have a lot of the accidental stuff that I wish we had. So, but there's a whole generation of scholars who've done a ton of sort of work kind of collecting and naming what we have is amazing. There's, the literary societies have done a beautiful job, but the literary societies, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien died like a week later, there's a Tolkien Society. C.S. Lewis dies and there's C.S. Lewis societies throughout the world. It's a whole generation before you really see the, and it's women teachers and readers in the United States and Canada who start to pull together these societies to see what they can do. And that takes a whole generation. And that's, and it's really feminist literary critics who recover Montgomery, intriguingly.
So how did the Modcast come about?
I was thinking about just what we were talking about, like, what's going on in Montgomery's world, how people are reading her. Anne with an E had been discontinued. And it didn't seem like there was another project like ready, right? So in fact, there still isn't, as far as I know, another major project that's in play. In Canada, in Japan, there might be like a zombie Anne of Green Gables or something. But like in Canada, in the United States, it doesn't seem like there's anything kind of in that line, but what we will have is a whole generation of new readers. And, you know, the Peter Jackson Tolkien films created a whole generation of amazing emergent scholars who are, it's the best ever, the scholarship. And so my hope is that Anne with an E will create a generation of Montgomery scholars that are the best ever. And we had a great first generation, just a late one. And so that, I was just thinking about that, and I'm like, well, what's needed? And so I was talking, I was at in the local cafe at the University of Prince Edward Island, and Kate Scarth is there, and she's the chair of Montgomery Studies here in Prince Edward Island. And I just kind of mentioned, you know, there should be a podcast. And we sat and we chatted and had coffee, and the word Modcast came up. And you have to be careful kind of sometimes what you wish for, because Kate was able to go out and sort of like get permission and seal it in and get a little bit of money to get things out of the gate and get some, like, a technician. Like, she did that. And I'm still kind of like just, you know, checking my phone. And so this was it. She just like, well, this is possible. Are we going to do this? Do you want to do this? And at first we cooked up the idea of short episodes, 10-minute episodes. But by then, in the meantime, COVID had created these, lockdown and stay at home orders and things like that. So for future listeners, this is spring 2021. This was all happening in spring 2020, and it was conceived before any of that. And we had a conference coming up in June. So we're going to sit down with people, do kind of a quick bite conversation live in a studio on campus. We just create a room basically with two mics, a studio, and go from there, right? And then of course none of that happens. Our conferences went digital. We're not moving anywhere. And so we had to rethink things. And in this time, this insatiable hunger for long, slow, deep conversations about life, the universe, and books has become a phenomenon, at least in this part of the world, right? And so we just decided this would be a great way to showcase scholars and artists and extend the conversation in a new way. And quite greedily for me, it keeps me kind of on the edge of things. I need to prep and I need to be well read. And I need to ask right questions, not just say the right things. And so it gives me a lot to be the Modcast host, is that I have to get ready for that sort of thing. And yeah, no, it's been great. It's been great so far. And each of the episodes are these, for Montgomery lovers, are these cool conversations that go deep into some aspect, some historical or literary or something. It's kind of cool.
Now, how do you feel about the Blue Castle? How does that one rank for you?
Yeah. And so I feel like someone challenged me on Twitter this morning. So I finished rereading the book this morning before getting up into the world. And so I gave it a 4-star review on Goodreads. Okay. So that's a pretty good review. And it's probably a 4-star from Montgomery, other writers of the period. It might be a 5-star for what was produced. And so what I mean is this. I think it's the first half is probably one of the funniest books that she ever produced. And it's probably one of the funniest books, I think, that comes out of that whole era, right? So she's not a comedy writer, but it's so good. Like Valency's transformation just sets her whole world into just a different light. And it's just so much fun to kind of walk through there, right? So we have all her sadness and drudgery. You know, she could have gone Dickens on the whole world that Valency lived in, right? Yeah. But instead of going Dickens, right, what she does is she just kind of turns on a light, and then there's like all the shadows in the corner. And, you know, it turns out we haven't been sitting on a couch. We've been sitting on a couch cover, and, you know, and everything is hidden beneath. And it's just, and I kind of miss that in the third quarter of the book. I feel like we lost something, and this might be me. So I'm a guy, right, reading this. I'm not a big romance reader. In fact, I don't love books that even have just like a romantic relationship as a theme. Like, I just don't care, right? Just not that interested. Yeah. And yet I love Jane Austen, right? But what do I love? I love Lizzie. Lost and found, right? I love Lizzie tumbling down the well of her own, you know, self-discovery, right? And Darcy, I guess I never was attracted to him like I think many readers were, right? So to be fair, you know, that's just, you know, gonna be true for me. He's kind of a looking glass character, right? So like, I think, And that's precisely what he is in the book. And Pride and Prejudice is he's one thing, and then Lizzie discovers that he's somebody else, right? And she discovers she's somebody else. And so I don't think he's unimportant or badly drawn, but to me, it's the brilliance of the character. It's Jane Eyre, right? She's just this depth there. And so I love that. She falls in love and stuff, like that's fine, you know, but like to me that was, I don't think the ending of Jane Eyre is the strongest part of the book necessarily, you know. And with Montgomery, and I know listeners who love her work are going to be a little anxious about this, I think that Montgomery is better at unfulfilling romance than she is at fulfilling it. Yeah. So I like, she's great at the tension. She's great at the never going to happen. She's great at the possibility of it. You know, Gilbert knows that he's in love with Anne and discovers that Anne will finally one day love him, or thinks that, hopes that, long before Anne has even thought anything other than this is just a chum. And that's better than them actually coming together. And in all honesty, like on film, it's different, right? But I like the later books, but I don't love them for the romance, I guess. The Anne's House of Dreams has some nice friendship scenes, but they're almost ruined by the narrator. He keeps on breaking in about how, like, you know, as they kiss on the porch, the twilight stars have never shone so bright before kind of stuff. And I just, I'm like, okay, well, I'd actually like them to go back to the parlor and argue or talk about something, because that would be more interesting. And so I think she's like, she creates these kind of tensions, and then she's better at, and then when they fulfill there, I don't know that there's anywhere to go. I think that we needed some, like all the tension comes at once, the whole thing falls apart at once. And then the question is whether it'll be all resolved at once, right? And I just think that I don't know that Montgomery knew exactly where to go in that middle part other than like the poles of the story, like the main pillars of the story, right? Whereas when we have a good ghost story, there's these kind of hints at the supernatural, like in just odd things that happen or the way that things, people have stories or histories or react to a sound, like all those normal things are foretelling of something else, right? And we have that on the lead up to the relationship, but we don't have that in the challenge that Barney and Valency will have. So,
you know, you're actually getting at something that I wished was pushed a little bit further in the Blue Castle early on. I didn't kind of feel this way at the end, but I will say at the beginning, I really responded to all of those sort of gothic elements of the story. Makes sense. I'm, you know, Team Bronte. I was really into sort of like Bluebeard's chamber and secrets. But then at one point I realized, you know what, Lauren, this is not the book you think it is. This is more of a fairy tale. This is more of a romance, just sort of like playing with those gothic elements a little bit.
Yeah. So I want to say that. So when I like, it's a romance only for me, only in the sense of the older word romance, which means adventure. So the Arthurian romance kind of is the way that people used to use the word. In Montgomery's imagination, the word romance doesn't have what it does today, where if I say a romance book, I'm in a certain part of the bookstore, right? And then when I get there and all the books have this sort of pale pink kind of cover, right? Then I have to say, well, no, I mean literary romance. Oh, and then we go to the bestsellers, right? So it's not as fulfilling to me, that kind of conversation. But she had all these different possibilities what romance meant. And then I think it totally is a fairy tale. I think it'd be tempting to read it as Cinderella, wouldn't it? Right? Like with the pile of dust. And I think that could be cool. I don't have any problem with that, but I think it definitely is a Bluebeard tale. And I hadn't thought of Jane Eyre though. I think of the Blue Castle as a literary experiment, kind of like Northanger Abbey is for Austen, right? And in a couple of ways. So like Northanger Abbey is this parody of Mysteries of Udolpho, which is really, I think I just finished for the first time a couple of weeks ago. And I think it's really too long to read. Yeah, no, I know. It took me a few tries and a few years, but it's really too long to read, I think, for someone like me. But beautifully written, but like an unforgivable digressions here and there and stuff like that. So, certainly a background to Northanger Abbey, like an out and out parody at points. But then, like, of course, Austen gets caught in her own character and her own world and then her own house. And then we're back in the parody a little bit. But then I don't know that Austen, maybe you could tell me, I don't know that she ever really fully commits to Northanger Abbey in the way that she does. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I love Northanger Abbey and we did a great read along series for that book. I think it's a great literary experiment and I love all of the, you know, the tributes, the name drops, everything that Austen is sort of doing in that text, especially sort of like her homage to Radcliffe, especially when, you know, Catherine opens the chest and she like fully becomes a Radcliffe heroine. But there's something at the end that's like missing for me with Northanger Abbey. I just think it needs just like one more push, like maybe something with the general. I don't know. But I hear you on this.
Yeah. I mean, I think Emma's a better character. I think Lizzie's a better character. And so it's missing a couple of things. Of course, it's still got, I mean, super funny. Same thing. First half of the book, super funny. Like, you know, the contrast of the things. You get both like a plain girl, kind of an underwhelming protagonist, I think, in both Northanger Abbey and Jane of Landernail, right? So I think there's some parallels there. And they're both literary experiments that I don't think quite pull themselves off once you get into the sort of the complexity of the plot. And so that's... that's kind of how I read those two things, but I hadn't thought of like, so when I read Bronte's Jane Eyre, I read Vampire Tale. Am I wrong? Like, yeah, it's a vampire. These are vampires, right? She keeps like dating or living with vampires, right? Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. So I'll say this. At first, Barney gave me these Rochester vibes, right? So it was just really the allure of this man with a dark past, like this potential bad boy for Valency to discover, right, during this last year that she has on Earth. But really, it is actually like the inverse, right? Like he's actually a great guy, and it's her family who she's just escaped. They're the vampires in actuality.
Yeah, well, so okay, so that's cool. So like, now the book was cool for me because I didn't guess where it was going, because I just don't think that way when I'm reading. But my wife, like, I think read the first page, is like, oh yeah, you know, the butler did it in the kitchen with the paring knife, right? So like, she's just that sort of a reader, so she just enjoyed it. But it had this kind of, like, the first time I read it some time ago, it had this kind of oddity to it that I'm like, okay, well, there we are. Like, here we are. Okay. And it's so fresh, you know, Valency just looks up and says, I think you should marry me, you know? And he laughs out loud, but not derisively. Right. He's like, well, tell me about that. Like, walk me into that. And then she does. And then he's like, I think I'll just go get that fixed up. You know, provided I don't run out of gas, I'll be back tomorrow. And so that's it's such a kind of an energetic and unusual, the word I wrote down a lot was inversive, like upside down. Everything turns upside down in the novel, right? You know, so you have, you know, finally, what was the phrase? You know, finally, when she finds out she's going to die, she discovers that she's never really lived. You know, she throws potpourri out the window, you know, because I just don't want to live with dead things anymore. We have like, she was afraid of everything. And then turns out she's not afraid of the ultimate thing. She's not afraid of death. So everything's kind of upside down. And so how is it with Barney Bluebeard, right? Yeah. And so the Bluebeard, for those that don't know the story, I would encourage them to read Angela Carter's Bluebeard, The Chamber of Secrets, her Bluebeard story. She's a feminist, British feminist writer from a generation ago. And it's a gorgeous and really troubling tale of the Bluebeard character. But it's just basically a wealthy hotelier, a wealthy homeowner brings in a young aristocratic family, or just off the land family girl, beautiful, into the house, marries her, goes off on business and leaves her a key and says, never go into the room in which this key enters, or everything will be ruined, right? And then she goes into the room, and what does she discover, right? It's like, it's a torture chamber, right? There's, you know, and skeletons and you know, bodies in various forms of torture of other women, right? And I guess that's, so do you guys have the phrase castles in the sky or doors in the air where you live?
Castles in the sky, for sure. I don't know about doors in the air.
Okay, but not, so doors in the air is sort of a Welsh, I think, one. So it's a Atlantic Canadian feeling. So doors in the air, your imaginative world. So castles in the sky. I think Montgomery called it castles in Spain was the phrase she uses, maybe in another book. I can't remember. So, but this has to be the Blue Castle, right? Because it's a Bluebeard tale, right? But I think I guess I didn't have any sense of foreboding. What I had was, because I had all this surprise, like, I didn't think she was stupid by saying, well, I actually don't want to know your old life. I don't, you know, are you a criminal? Why are you asking? Well, I'm just curious. Would it make any difference? No. Well, I don't want to satisfy curiosity. She's like, okay. Right. And because we have the inside narrator's point of view, we actually know how she feels about that. And she feels pretty good about that. This is like super unwise. And yet I've learned at this point in the book to trust Valency's instincts. Okay. What we have to discover in the book is Valency's instincts about people are better than her doubts about herself.
I love that you said that because it gives me an opportunity to bring it back to Northanger Abbey, because we have a protagonist that has sort of the opposite problem, right? Her instincts are not developed just yet. She misreads books, misreads people. Everyone does, actually, in that book. So it's just, you know, kind of the inverse situation. Another thing that happens in Northanger Abbey that I love are all of those intertextual references. And we have a big one in the Blue Castle with Mr. John Foster. Tell me, you know, what you think of that guy and his writing.
So Valency's in love with John Foster's writings. And turns out to be kind of in love with John Foster, right? And this is, you know, but she, John Foster, the character, is never one of her heroes in the castle in the sky, right? Like, or the Blue Castle, right? So he's not... she develops throughout her life with these different fantasies of what a man would be like, but it's not John Foster, intriguingly. But I've been kind of thinking about it, and John Foster's nature writing is actually really strong in the novel as nature writing. And I was thinking about, there's Beverly, a boy who's the narrator. He writes the story girl on the Golden Road the Golden Road, and which I'm reading right now again. So, and then Emily of New Moon is this really strong writer. And so I've been kind of wondering, like, are Emily and New Moon and Beverly King and John Foster, are they better writers than Montgomery? And that's kind of the question that I have, right? And if so, like, what's being released? Like, what's freeing about that process? And I'm kind of curious. The question, of course, is a nonsense question, you know, because she wrote them. But there's a book called Anne's House of Dreams, which is when Anne and Gilbert just get married. But the best part is Captain Jim and his life book. He has these kind of stories in his parlor. He's a lighthouse keeper. He has these stories in his parlor. Well, that's a kind of a part of that is a rewriting of, like, Captain, a short story from a couple of years earlier. I think that Elizabeth Epperly, a scholar, a Montgomery scholar, she discovered that some of the John Foster material, a good portion of it, is in nature writing that Montgomery did for another reason earlier on. And so that's kind of intriguing too. So it is intertextual, but it's a self, a looping of the self back in. So I don't know what to exactly say about the Blue Castle, because I think in the end she plays so lightly with that intertextual element. And she's not, like, I think usually when we have intertextuality, so when we have a story referencing or evoking another story, I think you want to kind of, when you click on that mentally, you're also going back to that whole world. So you think of Brave New World, right? You know, the Huxley novel, and he says, in the character in there, the native character says, "Oh, Brave New World!" Like, and so, and then it brings us right back again to the Tempest, to where it's the quotes from, and to the disorientation there. And so, you're meant to kind of live in both worlds as you're reading. I don't think we are. Like, I think we're meant to kind of have this playful wondering in our mind, and in the end, are we fulfilled about what's in Barney's secret cabin, like in the secret shed?
Well, as someone who loves drama and horror, it was quite the ride for me to find out that his secret was that he was rich and John Foster. I like it. I'm down. It just was a little bit much.
Well, yeah, I think I'm okay with him being John Foster, but I like, are there no buried bodies? That this could be psychologically interesting as a book. And I don't know that we get this much before this. What's the essential crisis for Barney and Valency in their life? Their essential crisis is a sense of self and self-worth with regard to the world. And each one rejects the world, right? And I think that's an intriguing thing. And so it's a reassertion of the self that happens. But in both characters, that ends up not being enough. So in the end, Barney discovers that he will die with his wife, who was just a companion, but now he discovers that he's in love with her, right? And then Valency ends up having a death and resurrection scene when she thinks that Barney's lost in the storm. And he comes, shows up the next morning, kind of walking in from the snow. And so in the end, we think that the resolution is the assertion of the self, but there's still another kind of loss of self and rediscovery of self. So it's an intriguing, there's a psychological complexity there that I'm sure there's lots of people writing like this, but in the writers of such a light fairy tale kind of verse, it's pretty unusual, I think.
And we are back. And we're ready to talk about sex. Amber, give us your general thoughts on this book. I know some of them, so that's why I'm leading us there. Okay. But yes, we're going to talk a little bit about Barney and then also some of the language that Montgomery is using in The Blue Castle, because it's very interesting, isn't it?
Yes. So one of the things that Lauren and I talked about and that I was completely surprised to hear is that there is debate about whether Valency and Barney have sex. And I thought, absolutely, they must do. I mean, she talks about his cheek being pressed on hers. They share the same bed. They do go on all of these swimming trips and canoe rides and ice skating. And they're definitely using their bodies out in nature. And I think that could, you know, that could take multiple forms, including sex. Mm-hmm. So I thought Valency's descriptions of the couple's forays into nature were just extremely lush and sexually charged. Don't you think?
Yes, like, I do.
What they encounter in nature is just so sensuously described. It's as if their own sexual appetites and satisfactions are kind of projected onto or displaced onto nature and onto these descriptions of ripe, succulent berries and heavy pendant fruit and erect stalks.
That is such a good point. And I just want to point that out real quick, because I read this book. I'm still reading, like I read an entry a day out of Susan Fenimore Cooper's Rural Hours, which I'm going to talk about in the next episode. But it's very like documentarian. Her and John Foster are talking about the same things, but it is not sexual at all.
No. I'm glad you said that, because it feels very different. This is not about this is not about minutely describing what you encounter in nature. It's about describing nature aesthetically and about thinking through your response to nature, I think. So it becomes this kind of sensuous or sensory experience. It's not about documentation or anatomizing. It's about experience and immersion. So there was one passage in particular that really stopped me dead in my tracks. And again, I had not read Montgomery prior to The Blue Castle, but I was familiar with Anne of Green Gables and that story. And so I came to this text with some expectations of what I thought it might be like. And those expectations were completely and entirely subverted, especially when it comes to the way that Montgomery describes Valency's and Barney's courtship. The tenderness and simultaneously the dignity with which he treats Valency, I feel like that is so almost unique. You know, he treats her like this thinking, sentient, independent being with a will of her own, and yet he buttons the coat up to her chin. He's very loving and tender. It's a really interesting dynamic. And I was also really struck by the eroticism of Montgomery's descriptions of Valency and Barney enjoying their connection with nature and with one another. So here's that passage that I had picked out. There were long grasses at the roots of the birches, combed down by the winds and wet with morning dew late into the afternoons. Here they found berries that might have graced the banquets of Lucullus, great ambrosial sweetnesses hanging like rubies to long rosy stalks. They lifted them by the stalk and ate from it, uncrushed and virgin, tasting each berry by itself with all its wild fragrance ensphered therein. When Valency carried any of these berries home, that elusive essence escaped, and they became nothing more than the common berries of the marketplace. Very kitchenly good indeed, but not as they would have been, eaten in their birch dell until her fingers were stained as pink as Aurora's eyelids. What did you think of this, Lauren? I mean, it's definitely sexually charged. It's definitely pregnant with all of this feeling.
It is sexy as hell, especially I wish I had a Cooper, you know, response where it's just like, okay, and today I saw these songbirds and they were eating these berries. And it's just very, again, mm-hmm. documentarian. This is what's happening in nature, but also still beautifully written, but not mm-hmm. sexually charged. Because, I'm just like, oh, Valency and Varney are doing things in those woods.
Yes.
Which is
absolutely.
Fine.
Absolutely. Yes. But it's, I don't know how to explain it. It's as if it's written in such a way that the reader is under no mistake that this is romantic, it's sexual, it's passionate, it's erotic. And yet there's nothing that's really risque about it. I mean, they're just eating berries. She treads that line so beautifully. So I'm impressed. I'm a big fan. What it reminded me of at first on a first reading was actually Christine Rossetti's Goblin Market. And I'm sure listeners to the podcast will be aware of Goblin Market. It's a story about two cottage maidens, Laura and Lizzie, and they hear the song of the goblin men, and one of the sisters buys the fruit with a golden curl, and she gets all of this delicious, ripe, succulent fruit that she can't get in her everyday life. I mean, these are fruits that come from foreign ports. These are imported fruits. They're luxury items. And it's described so sensuously. I mean, these are ripe, unpecked cherries, but this kind of language that really equates the consumption of fruit to the consumption of women's bodies and the consumption of forbidden pleasures and the indulgence of appetites. And it's a really complex allegory, but one way that you can read it and one way that it has been read is that it's the story of a sexual fall, that this woman's appetites for forbidden fruit bring her to the brink of ruin and destruction and decay, and she starts to wither, and it's only through the sacrifice of her sister that she's able to regain strength and break the goblin's spell and their hold on her. And this passage is so interesting because it works exactly the opposite way. Valency's appetites are not problematic. Valency's appetites do not lead to destruction and decay. Valency's appetites kind of awaken her to the possibility of more appetites and a closer relationship. And I think that there's something special and important in that as well. I mean, I'm definitely not one of those people who like to pretend that the Victorians never had sex and that there was nothing sexy and that mm-hmm. all sex was bad and led to ruin and all of that. But if you look at the Blue Castle and you look at the way that Sissy's trajectory is laid out, it is very much the story that you would see through things like Thomas Hood's The Bridge of Sighs. Might not have that title correct, Lucy, might have to check that, but yeah, like that kind of poetry or those stories about fallen women who give into their passions, and they take this forbidden fruit and this sexual experience, and then they're punished by it. And then once they die, they're somehow redeemed, and everyone says, oh, they had such a sad, poor life. Mm-hmm. And then they're kind of recuperated, and everyone can feel good about themselves because, you know, they've kind of cried and wrung their hands over this person that actually they ostracized when they were in life. Valency's situation is totally different. And Valency is the one who proposes to Varney. Valency is the one who recognizes that she's in love first. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of taboo. I mean, if you look at, I know I'm Bronte obsessed, but if you look at Charlotte Bronte's letters to Ellen Nussie, they talk about like, okay, well, when is the appropriate time to let on to a man that you're interested in him? And Charlotte says at one point, like, oh, you should marry him, and then you should allow yourself to fall in love, and only then, that's the only time when it's safe. Right. You know, when you can say like, I'm in love with you, I want to have sex with you. It's once you're actually married and it's totally sanctioned by church and state. Whereas Balancy is like, I love him. We had a sexy midnight car ride. He buttoned my coat. It was really nice. I love you. And the other thing that's really, that I love about Balancy is she just does not care if he loves her back. He treats her well. Right. He's attentive to her needs. He allows her to be her true self. You know, whether that's sitting in silence or making a funny, witty quip or being a little bit irreverent or talking about real things or talking about literature. He just allows Valency to be her full entire self. And she doesn't need him to be in love with her yet.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And it's just such, I know it doesn't sound very academic, but it's such a satisfying portrayal of a relationship that a woman can take the lead, that a woman can propose to a man, that a woman can enjoy sex, that a woman can get married, not with any thought of eternity, but with a thought of, this will be a pleasurable way to spend my last weeks on earth.
Yeah.
It's all about indulging her appetites and not in an exploitative, creepy, coercive kind of way either. She just lays it all out on the table. I kind of love Balancy. I think that's so incredibly brave and ballsy. And I think that that's reflected in this passage.
So now before we jump into some Facebook comments, which I think are going to generate some really interesting discussions here, I do want to recommend an author for you all to check out if you enjoy Montgomery's just, you know, sexy nature writing. And that author is E. Pauline Johnson. Her first name is Emily. Her mother's first name was Emily as well. So from here on out, I'm just going to refer to her as Pauline Johnson, which was basically her stage name. So Pauline Johnson was mixed race. Her father was a Mohawk chief on the Six Nations Reserve, and her mother was from Bristol, England. And Pauline was a performer, and she would put on these stage shows where she would perform this like dual identity, and she would recite her poetry in two acts. So one act dressed in a very conventional Victorian gown, and then there would be an act break and she would come back out in native dress. And Johnson was very popular in her day and traveled all over Canada and England to recite poetry, which I actually thought was really interesting because some of these pieces are like very confrontational and they would address colonialism head on, which I think is really brave of her to just go to England. And she performed for like the aristocracy and would just go, hey, colonialism is bad to their faces. And they were like, we love it. Do it again.
I love it.
That's a whole situation to unpack. I mean, we will someday unpack all of that on this show. But some of her pieces, however, have the sort of same sexy love, nature, magic that is present in Montgomery's work. So here's one. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. It's called The Lost Lagoon. I really like this poem. It is dusk on the lost lagoon, and we two dreaming the dusk away, beneath the drift of a twilight gray, beneath the drowse of an ending day, and the curve of the golden moon, it is dark in the lost lagoon, and gone are the depths of a haunting blue, the grouping gulls and the old canoe, the singing firs and the dusk, and you. And gone is the golden moon, O lure of the lost lagoon. I dream tonight that my paddle blurs the purple shade where the seaweed stirs. I hear the call of singing firs in the hush of the golden moon. So I'm pretty sure that this poem is about two people getting it on in a canoe. I mean, I am not great with poetry analysis. I think we all know this.
Me either.
But this is my feeling on this. I could absolutely be wrong. Probably what's a better poem to discuss, actually, is she has a poem called Muskoka, which I happened to read while I was reading The Blue Castle. And Muskoka, of course, is where The Blue Castle is set. And where Ellen Montgomery took that trip that inspired her to write The Blue Castle. So we have plans to do an entire episode on Johnson. Ideally, we'd love to go up to her literary home in Canada. Of course, pandemic time. So, you know, who knows when and if that will happen. But I highly recommend you check out her work. I think it's really interesting. I also really wonder what's going on up there in Muskoka. It must be gorgeous, like, to inspire all of this literature. If you live in or have been to Muskoka, send me photos. I would love to see them. Send me your experiences. I want to hear about them. I want to know. So we are now going to talk about some Facebook comments, because we get great comments from you guys every week on these books. And yeah, let's dig into it.
Well, one of the comments that I really loved was from Anna B. I had been thinking about Bluebeard's castle since I started the book, so I was pleased to hear Valency and Barney joke about his previous wives being hidden in there. I wonder if there is something about the experience of trapped women in the reference, but perhaps it is inverted so that Barney's shack / Valency's blue castle is the place of emancipation and the red brick family home is the one of shackles and fear. But there's still a question mark for me over Barney's man cave. We find out later he doesn't want her to go in, but why doesn't she want to? Why isn't she curious?
Great comment.
I love this comment because, yeah, when we had talked about my co-hosting this episode, I remember messaging you about the Blue Castle and the way that Valency writes about how she has a succession of young, ardent men that she dreams up that correspond to different stages in her life. So, you know, when she's really young, a young teenager, that idealized boy looks very different from the more rugged man that she imagines as a 29-year-old in her blue castle. And I thought that was really interesting that this is kind of a space where she has absolute control. And this is the only space that she has, this imagined space. It's the only room of her own or the only place where she can have any kind of privacy. Right. So she has absolutely no privacy. She is constantly asked, why are you going to your room? What are you doing there? And for me, the implication is that they don't want her masturbating. That's what I always thought. Why are you in your bedroom, Valency? And in terms of decor, it doesn't look the way she wants it to. There's the ugly purple shade. There are the pictures that she hates, the little puppy out in the rain. Not a bit of that room reflects her life or her interests or her aesthetic or her desires. She can't even go upstairs and read a damn nature book. It is absolutely ridiculous, the level of surveillance that Valency is under. And she's also under surveillance in terms of, like, are you wearing a flannel petticoat? What does your underwear look like, Valency? You can't determine whether you're hot or you're cold. You can't determine whether to go out. You can't determine whether you're actually sick. You can't determine what you want to eat. You can't determine what time you want to eat. You can't decide what you want to talk about. Every single part of her life has been decided for her by her mother and cousin Stickle. She has absolutely no freedom except within this blue castle that she creates. So for me, I kind of thought at first, I did think it was weird. Well, why is she not curious? Does she think maybe there are women in Barney's shed? Why does she accept a relationship where some things are secret? Isn't she concerned about his truthfulness? And then on the other hand, she only has what she thinks are a few weeks or maybe a few months to live. She doesn't think she's going to live to see another year. Barney treats her really well, and she knows what it's like to have people pry into her secret life and try to rifle through it and find out all of the details. She knows what it's like to not have a single thing to herself. I mean, they're the really pathetic moments where she talks about wanting her own dust pile. It's absolutely heartbreaking. Right. And so, of course, I see her thinking, well, I'm not going to disrupt Barney's Blue Castle or his shed or his man cave or his dust pile. He's allowed to have something else. This is one of the things that makes me feel like this is such a modern story. I mean, it's a woman accepting this man with all of his idiosyncrasies and all of his unconventionalities and his privacy and his secrets. And she just accepts it. People deserve to have secrets. People deserve to have some private things. People deserve to set boundaries and say, okay, well, we have this life together, but this part is mine. This is my Blue Castle. Yeah. This is my man cave. This part is mine. I love that they set boundaries and that they each abide by those boundaries.
Yes. Oh, I love that you brought up the privacy thing. I had wondered, although it's not in the text, so this is just me projecting onto the text, that part of me was like, well, yeah, she only has a few weeks to live. Like, maybe it's like, I don't want to disrupt a good thing. Like, I've got this dream. Everything's going well for me. And like, yeah, like he can. Mm-hmm. I've kind of come into his life.
Right.
This is like his place already. And so, yes, he's setting this boundary of like, you know, I'll look after you. I'll take care of you. You can have however much money you want from this jar. But like, mm-hmm. this thing is mine. And she's like, yeah, all right, cool. I'm not going to rock the boat. Yeah.
And she, on for her part, says, you're never to remind me that I am going to die. You're not to remind me that I have limited yeah. time. You're not to bring it to my attention. And he abides by that too. And the part that was really gut-wrenching scenes, like when Valency wakes up and he's gone after she has that near miss with the train, mm-hmm. he's absenting himself because he wants to break that rule. He wants to talk to her about the shortness of her life. He wants to talk to her about specialists, and he is trying to be respectful of the boundary that she set. I mean, that's not an act of abandonment like we think mm-hmm. it might be. It's an act of love. It's an act of trying to allow her to be the person that she wants to be, to agree to the terms that she set out. Mm-hmm. It's actually wildly romantic when you think about it. You know, he never yeah. says, oh my God, you were almost hit by a train. You haven't had a heart attack. What's yeah. going on? What do you think the prognosis is? Is there any hope? You know, he wrestles with himself. He takes the whole day away and wrestles with himself. Do I bring this up? Do I break her trust in this way? Do mm-hmm. I violate that boundary? Do I cross it? So I feel like Valency is respectful of his boundary, and he is just as respectful of hers. I feel like this is such a refreshing and kind of wholesome relationship where they yeah. have, you know, sexy times that are like healthy and outdoors and not transactional mm-hmm. and mutually enjoyable and pleasurable. And yeah, and they have their shared love, and they have their shared love of nature and getting to know one another, but they also have parts of their lives that are private and that are kept yeah. separate.
So Rose had a great comment. She said that, I just want to say that I listened to the audiobook twice in a row last week, and it really cheered me up. Can we call The Blue Castle a romance novel? I understand that the modern romance genre is usually considered to have come later in the 20th century, but I really think that this book fits the bill. Married but keeping it casual is the original fake dating, surely. There's a lot of like romance tropes, or now what are romance tropes in this mm-hmm. book. I mean, even like what I said earlier with the, you know, the car breaking down mm-hmm. and them stranded, you know, that's definitely in yeah. there as well. It's really interesting, actually.
Yeah, being thrown together in close proximity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ellen Montgomery would have killed it as a romance writer today. I would have loved to have actually seen a sex scene written by Ellen Montgomery, mm-hmm. to be honest. I think Ellen Montgomery and Elizabeth Gaskell, they would have crushed sex scenes, by the way. I'll die on that hill. So Sarah B started the sex conversation in our group, but I do want to point out that this is like across the board on the internet. So This is in so many discussions of the Blue Castle and was recently in, I believe it was an Ellen Montgomery Society like Zoom meeting that they had over the Blue Castle that was posted on YouTube that I posted in our group. Are they having sex is the number one thing. So Sarah B. said, I just love him calling her Moonlight. I know. I think that was really cute. And here's an 18 plus question for fan fiction. Did they consummate? I'm thinking no. It doesn't seem to be implied, but it's interesting to think about. They sleep in the same bed. Is there any textual evidence for or against? And how does your interpretation of whether they did or didn't change your understanding of their relationship? I'm going to read Carrie's response because I think you guys know how we feel about it. So Carrie said, I assume that they had. In chapter 27, there is a conversation from Valency. Why is it indecent to have your husband put his arm around you? I should think it would be indecent if you didn't. Why expect decency from her? Inquired Uncle James sarcastically. She has made her bed, let her lie in it. Thanks, said Valency gratefully. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but I took the thanks as thanking him for allowing her sexual choice of lying on her bed and not just thanking him for the proverb he intended. My reading is that the entire book is very sexually charged because we begin with her daydreaming about men. Then she very actively puts Barney in her blue castle. Mm-hmm. And then she proposes to him. They get married. And then she says, my blue castle is now real. So I really take that to be like a direct line of I used to masturbate or daydream. I used to daydream about this person and now they're very real. And I think that she wanted to experience life fully. That was her whole thing. Like, right. I'm dying. I want to experience all of it.
Right.
I want to dance. I want to have sex. I want to buy a green dress. I want to do all of it.
Absolutely. And I think too, Montgomery is kind of commenting or turning the mirror back on a time and society where a woman's worth was really rooted in her ability to attract a mate, to get married, to produce a child, to have sex. I mean, she was a sexual creative being, the ideal woman. She wasn't, you know, a lonely spinster living out her life as a poor dependent on her family. And there is so much pressure, or there was so much pressure on women at that time to be selected, to have a mate, to produce a child. I think Valency continuously grapples with that. I'm in the earlier chapters where she walks down the street and she says, oh, that guy bought this nice, beautiful house for his intended. And I'm not really that fussed about the guy, but wow, having this house. I mean, to be the keeper of a house for Valency, at least, you would have to be a married woman. I mean, this is without her earning any kind of money, but typically you become the head of a household when you're married. You move into your husband's house, you keep house for him. Mm-hmm. So this is a really, really rambly way of saying that, like, in a society that privileges married women and that looks down on unmarried women as cast aside or as unfulfilled or as less than or incomplete in and of themselves, it's not at all surprising that she would be focused on sexual fulfillment and sexual experience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like women are supposed to be doing this, but they're also supposed to act as if they're absolutely not thinking of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. That's the thing. That's the line you have to walk. And that's the line that Montgomery is really walking, right? She's not saying the thing. And I feel like maybe the thesis of this book could be what Valerie O said. Now, this is a quote from chapter 17. She said, I love this quote. Isn't it better to have your heart broken than to have it wither up? Queried Valency. Before it could be broken, it must have felt something splendid. That would be worth the pain. And I feel like that's the whole thing for this book. That like sums it up, basically.
Right. Because her long sojourn with her mother and Cousin Stickles hasn't broken her heart. It's worn her down. It's made her sad. But ultimately, no one has the power to break her heart. The only person who has the power to break her heart is Barney when she thinks that he has left her or suspected her of tricking him. So it's true. And I think that also relates to the idea of fear, that Valency was a person who allowed fear to control her, fear of her mother's displeasure, fear of Cousin Stickles, fear of being disinherited, fear of being an old maid, fear of shocking people. I mean, this is a very gossipy small town. And she just throws caution to the wind and allows herself to be hurt and allows herself to be vulnerable, which is kind of beautiful, I think.
Yeah.
I love Valency.
Yes. It's a very good quote. This book is super quotable. And there are so many good quotes that we're going to discuss next week when we just talk about the ending. There's a lot going on in that ending.
Yes.
It's a lot happening.
Yeah, so, it was shocking. I just, like, every time I got to a new point, I was like, what?
A lot happens. Like, it really picks up at the end and it really moves in this way. There's a lot going on. We're going to be breaking down that ending with Hannah. Hannah will be back and talking about a lot of like life lessons learned from the Blue Castle, as well as health stuff. And we'll dive back into Ellen Montgomery's life a little bit more. So return next week for the conclusion of The Blue Castle. And if you want to check in with us before then, you can find us on the internets. Of course, we are at bonnetsatdawn@gmail.com. We are at Bonnets at Dawn on Facebook, Bonnets at Dawn on Twitter and Instagram. So you can find us there. And also, Why She Wrote is available now. So you can buy our book if you are so inclined. No L.M. Montgomery in that book, but maybe in the future. Maybe. We'll see. So thank you so much, Amber, for joining us today. This was great. And everyone, read The Goblin Market and let us know what you think.
Let's have a whole Goblin Market discussion.
Yes, that sounds good.